Saram, dear listeners, and welcome once again to Vahini Satsang. By Bhagwan's grace, we are now in the chapter 21st of Prema Vahini. And today we take up the third segment, and along with me, as always, is Sai Prakash, and we also have Brother Sai Girdhar, who has been joining us the last few sessions. So let's listen to the third segment of chapter 21 of Prema Vahini, and then we'll pray to Bhagwan and see what he inspires all of us for this session.
మానవునకు శ్రవణద్వారము ద్వారా దుఃఖము ఆనందము కలుగుచున్నది. కనుక బాణములాంటి కఠిన వాక్కులను ఉపయోగించక అతి మధురమైన ఆనందమయమైన మృదుభాషను ఉపయోగించుచు ఆ మార్గమునందే సత్యమాధుర్యమును చేర్చవలెను. మృదుభాష గదాయని అందులో అసత్యమును చేర్చినా అది మరింత దుఃఖమునకు దారితీయను. సాధువైనవాడు అతి మృదువు మధురము సత్యము ఆనందమయమైన వాక్కుతో మెలగవలెను. ఇట్టివాణి సుగుణములను ముఖమును బట్టియే గ్రహించవచ్చును. కావున సాధకుడైన వానికి మనస్సు మధుర, హృదయము ద్వారక, దేహము కాశీ. 10 ద్వారముల నిలయములో పరంజ్యోతిని దర్శనము చేసుకునవలెను. హృదయము పరిశుభ్రము కానిదే ఏమి చేసియును లాభము లేదు. చేపను చూడు, ఎల్లప్పుడూ నీటిలోనే నివసించి దాని దుర్వాసననేమైనా వదిలించుకున్నదా? లేదు. అహంకార వ్యామోహములతో చేరిన హృదయము పరిశుభ్రపరచు ఎన్ని సాధనల ఉన్నను మానవుని వాసన పోదు. అట్టి మానవుని అహంకార మమకార వాసనలు పోవలెనన్నా హరిని భజించవలెను. వికారరహితుడైన సాధకుడు కావలెను. వికారము సాధుత్వము ఒకే హృదయమున నిలువబోవు. ప్రకాశము అంధకారము ఏనాటికిని ఒకేచోట ఒక సమయమున నివసించబోవుగదా. అరిషడ్వర్గములు ఎవరి హృదయమున రాజ్యమేలునో వానికి అహంకారమే మంత్రిగా ఉండును. అట్టి మంత్రిత్వమును పొందినవాడు ఎంత పండితుడైనను, ఎంతటి సాధు అయినను, సన్యాసి అయినను మూర్ఖులతో సైతం సమానుడు కాడు. పరిమళము మోయ గార్ధవము గజమగునే అన్నట్లు మంచి గంధపు చెక్కలను గాడిద మోసినంత మాత్రమున అది గజమగునా? దానికి భారము తెలియను కాని వాసన తెలియదు. అదే గజమైన భారము నేమాత్రము గమనించక అతి మధురమైన వాసనను మాత్రమే స్వీకరించును కదా. అటులనే సాధకుడు కాని సన్యాసి కాని భక్తుడు కాని సద్విషయములందును సర్వేషునియందును శాస్త్రవేద ఉపనిషత్తులందున్న పవిత్రమైన నిజభావమును నిజసారమును గమనించవలెను. కాని అట్లుకాక కేవలము పాండిత్యము కోసము ప్రజల కొరకు తర్కించుచూ పోవుచుండినా వానికి ఆ తర్కమే తెలియను కాని సత్యము తెలియదు. చూచువారలు శాస్త్రవేద సారాంశుడందురు కాని సారమే లేనప్పుడు ఇక అంశమెక్కడా? సారమును వెదకువాడు భారమును చూడడు, లెక్క చేయడు. కేవలము తెలివిని వినియోగించినా తేలునది ఏమియునూ ఉండదు.
మ్యాన్ ఇస్ ఎక్స్పీరియన్సింగ్ జాయ్ అండ్ మిజరీ త్రూ ద ఇయర్. Therefore, avoiding the cruel arrows of harsh words, one should use words that are sweet, pleasant and soft, and with that softness, add the sweetness of truth. To make the word soft, if falsehood is added, it would only clear the way for some more misery. A person who has become a sadhaka should use very soft, sweet, true and pleasant words. The good qualities of such persons are evident from their faces. Thus, of those who have become sadhakas, the manas or mind is mathura, the hridayam or the heart is dwaraka, and the deha or the body is kashi. In this abode, which has 10 gates, one can witness the paranjyoti, the supreme effulgence. All efforts are of no avail if the heart is not pure. Look at the fish, living as it does perpetually in water, Has it rid itself of its foul smell to any extent? No. The vasanas of man will not disappear even if he is immersed in many heart purifying sadhanas, so long as the heart is filled with infatuation and egoism. Such a man, if he is desirous of getting rid of the feeling of I and mine, must worship Hari. He must become a sadhaka without likes and dislikes. Vikaras like these cannot coexist along with the sadhu nature in the same heart. Light and darkness can never exist together at the same place and same time. He whose heart is ruled by the group of six vices can have only Ahankara as his minister. Those who have such a minister are worse than foolish men, even if they are great pandits, sadhus or sannyasins. Can a donkey carrying perfume become an elephant? Can an ass change into an elephant simply by carrying a bundle of sandalwood? It can appreciate the weight, but not the scent. But the elephant pays no regard to the weight. It inhales the sweet scent, isn't it? So too, the sadhaka or the sannyasin or the bhakta will take in only the pure truth, the pure essence of good activities, of godliness, and of the shastras, Vedas and Upanishads. On the other hand, if for the sake of mere scholarship, learning and disputation, one goes on arguing, he will only know the weight of logic and miss the scent of truth. The onlookers may praise them as the embodiments of the shastras and of the Vedas, but where even the essentials are lacking, how can there be an embodiment? For those in search of the essence, the burden is no consideration. If mere reason is employed, nothing worthwhile is gained.
So, of course, it's a long segment and a very profound one. I remember Brother Sai Prakash mentioning some time back in one of our discussions how Swami insisted that a soft, sweet speech is an essential part of any sadhaka. In fact, the first thing that Swami expects of any sadhaka.
Absolutely.
And here in this segment, Swami has emphasized that so much. And then Bhagwan goes on to talk about purity. I think, you know, sadhaka and soft words, the soft words will make one, put one on the path of being a sadhaka. And once you are a sadhaka, the most important thing that one should aspire to do, strive to do, is become pure. I think that is what is, I remember Swami saying in so many discourses, purity is the essence of all sadhana. And I think that is what Swami is stressing here again and again. Because there is no point in you undertaking any number of spiritual acts if you have not taken the trouble to clean yourself of the impurities within. I think that is what is the crux of what Bhagavan is saying. And when you're talking about impurities, everything comes from ahamkara, from ego. I think that is the foundation on which all the impurities stand. And silence and soft speech is the foundation on which all the virtues stand.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
See, the power of words is something which Swami has emphasized a lot.
Yes.
And as students, I would always remember Swami would say two things for student: talk less,
yes,
have less contact.
Has less.
And these were always Swami's instructions. These two things, if you, in fact, Swami used to have a reward system in place. Like,
yes,
if you talk less, I will take you to Kodaikanal.
Kodaikanal. Yes.
And so, some of the, I remember one of our seniors, he kept Maunam for nearly a year. For several months, he just decided he is not going to speak unless it's absolutely essential. And Swami did take him to Kodaikanal.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, talking less has been something which Swami has always insisted. But here Swami is talking about the effect of words.
Yes.
That, you know, the words, good words
yes.
and bad words cause injury and harm to us. I was just going through some of the research that has been done in this field. And amazing results. You know, for us, Swami says, ah, yes, yes, it's fine. But if science says we take to it a little, it's more easier for us to accept because of, you know, our mind is always wired towards thinking logically and we think, okay, if science is saying this, then it must be true. So, you know, so anyway, I was just seeing this a TED talk by Dr. Mark Robert Waldman. Waldman. It's a TEDx talk in YouTube. And in a very dramatic way, he starts his talk. He says, I'm going to speak about how to change your brains. And he says, literally, there is one word which has found to have a tremendous impact on your brain. And that is God.
Oh, wow.
He says that. He says, I'm not a theist, I'm this thing, I'm a scientist, I'm a critic. But when I saw the results for myself, it is astounding. He says the word God has such an impact on your brain. And Andrew Newberg and Mark Robert Waldman, I think these two,
what sort of an impact did he amplify on?
I'll just give you some more points based on what research they have done. I think they did research in the University of Pennsylvania, and they have been doing research on different types of people on the power of words on the brain. Now, what he says is, and they have come out with a book called Words Can Change Your Brain. Words Can Change Your Brain.
Yes.
And in that book, they have actually outlined a concept called compassionate communication. They said compassionate communication, that means how do you communicate to be able to lead a successful life,
yes,
to have good relationships with others, to be successful with your you know, your family, with your boss, with your colleagues. So they say there is a clear 12-step process. In the book they are supposed to have highlighted a clear 12-step steps that can change your brain structure. And this is all scientifically proven. This is all, you know, there. And they say this feature of the brain which adapts and changes and which modifies and grows into something else is called neuroplasticity.
Yeah.
Neuroplasticity is something which they are. So now when you asked what is the effect of the word God on the brain, surprisingly, they realized that, for example, they gave an example. They said, suppose you are being wheeled into the MRI machine. And as you go into the MRI machine, for less than a second, the word no is flashed in front of you. He's saying it's incredible the number of neurotoxins and the number of hormones, stress hormones that are being produced by your brain. Even for a split second, the word no can trigger so much of fight and flight. It triggers the fight and flight syndrome. So when they did their research, what they realized is certain parts of the brain which triggers these responses is hardwired to preserve your very survival. So, you know, the urge to survive.
Yes.
The urge to survive is one of the most primal needs of a human. It comes right from the animal. So the need to survive is actually what causes fear. And, you know, any negative word immediately triggers those hormones and neurotransmitters. And, you know, then what they say, give an example, they say an angry word. For example, if any angry words are used, the word sends alarm messages through the brain and partially shut down the logic and reasoning centers in the frontal lobes. So when somebody gets angry, the whole brain structure, the frontal part of the brain which actually deals with the logical way of thinking, logical approach, it just shuts down.
That's why they say don't take decisions when you're angry. Just like don't promise things when you're too happy. Don't take decisions when you're angry.
He says that amygdala, which is the center for fear, he says that is directly connected to the primal urge, the need of everybody to survive. Now, what happens when he says you fill your mind with positive words? Like God is one of the most positive. And he says your understanding of the word God is also very important. If you approach God with the feeling, the word God itself triggers a lot of action. But if you approach the word God with positivity, the impact is more, is different. So he says, by holding positive and optimistic words in your mind, the frontal lobe activity is stimulated. Okay. This has specific language centers connected to the motor complex responsible for moving you into action. So the moment positive words are contemplated upon, they are connected to your motor cortex, which aids your action. So then he says, positive words also affect the other part of your brain, and functions of your parietal lobe start to change, which changes your perception of yourself and the people you interact with. I mean, this is all scientifically they have experimented, just the power of words.
Yes.
And he says, positive view of yourself will bias you towards seeing good in others too. He says, when you see negativity in yourself, then you start doubting others, you start having suspicion, you have all this. Then he says, over time, if you keep filling your mind with positivity, positive thoughts, the structure of your thalamus changes. The thalamus is, I believe, a small part in the brain. And he says the very structure of the thalamus is changing because of constant positive thinking. And he says this affects the way you perceive reality. this was something which is stunning. He says you are making your own perception of this world. I remember the first chapter in Premavahini, Swami says,
yes,
you imagine the world to be in a particular way, and you are engulfed by your imagination.
Yad bhavam tad bhavati.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So that is what Swami said in the first chapter. And these people, they are come out with this scientific research of how words have that pause. And of course, we all know about those the experiments about the Japanese doctor,
Masaru Emoto. That's moving from possibly what the hardcore scientists would say from neuroscience to pseudoscience. They didn't really acknowledge it as a proper science for many reasons, as to, there were questions like how would the water actually read what's there in the paper. Those were some unanswered questions which were still, but nevertheless, what was irrefutable in Professor Masaru Emoto's experimentations were that when the water was exposed to negative words, like hatred, anger, and when it was frozen, in fact, in the year 1994, he got the idea that he can expose water to these words and, freeze the water and use high-speed photography to capture the crystal structures to capture the photograph of the, not crystal structure, but the photograph of the crystal that
water
is forming.
Molecules.
Water crystal that is forming, ice crystal.
Yes.
So when he did that, he found that these harsh words or negative words would invariably disturb the crystal formation, and it would be haphazard. And similar results were obtained when he exposed the water to hard rock music and the like. But when he put expressions like love, gratitude, these positive words in the beaker, so the crystals that formed were very, very beautiful. They were symmetric.
Yes.
They had a charm of their own.
Yes.
And they were very, again, similar to the results that he obtained when he exposed the water to classical music, for that matter.
Yes.
Right? So it is kind of, the inferences at least indicate, though one may not be very sure about the actual process by which it is happening, but the results definitely indicate that water, when exposed to a particular reverberancy of a word or a feeling, definitely responds to it in a particular way. And it is actually very staggering and stunning, because we know that majority of our own human body and the earth is made of water, right?
Absolutely.
So constantly our thoughts and our emotions are now deciding the biochemistry, because all the functions of the body happens through the medium, majority of the functions happen through the medium, which is water.
Absolutely.
So that means every thought we have or every word that we speak is very, very important. In fact, I remember one session, I think in the early 2001 or so, Swami was seated in the Ganesh portico, and he was talking about this subject of silence and why we shouldn't talk too much. In fact, he also said you shouldn't hear too much, right? And the description that Swami gave at that time is quite vivid in my memory. And Bhagavan said, in the brain, there are some kind of lasers. These are the exact words that Swami used. Swami said, there are some lasers in the brain. What happens to them is, they are generally of high energy. The more you practice silence, and the less you also listen to unnecessary or jarring or harsh sounds, the laser grows in its energy and intensity. But moment you start talking more and more, and you also keep listening in the process, what happens is the power of this laser, which is in lasers, which are there in the brain, they come down, and as a result, you lose memory power, power of concentration, and various other faculties of the brain diminish.
Wow.
This is something which Swami used to tell us and say, so Bangarus, you should practice silence, you know, and we would actively do that. In the higher secondary school at Prashantinilayam, we have this Thursday Maunam concept, right?
We used to compete on Maunam.
To compete, who would, you know, actually hold it for the longest time and not utter a single word and all that. It used to be really funny, because everybody is using sign language and stuff like that. But it is interesting, because all the students would, you know, in order to please Bhagwan, you know, they would take up this initiative. And regarding this, you know, the first sentence that Bhagwan says in this particular segment, man is experiencing joy and misery through the ear. That's how this segment begins. I heard an interesting talk of one of the great Vedantins of Bharat, Swami Chinmayananda. And Swamiji was mentioning something very interesting. He said, do you know why you have to speak softly and sweetly? Because God has put the closest hearing device, right, is your own ear that is next to your mouth, right? So whatever you utter, the first person to listen to what you utter is yourself, because your ear is the closest hearing device that is placed next to your mouth.
And there's only one talking device, but two listening devices.
two listening devices, you know. And that is why it is very, very important the words we utter and, you know, what we speak, because those words, we are the first recipients of whatever impact they have to make, because we are listening to it ourselves. So that doesn't mean we wear earplugs and then we can still hear it from inside. So it's very important that these words are given. Especially, I would like to add here that it's not just the word, but the energy of the word is kind of defined by the attitude that is held behind. Like, say, for example, the teachers and the parents will definitely adopt a stronger stance. So they might sound sometimes little serious or strong in their words. But when it is done with the background of love to, you know, help the student progress or to correct, then it is okay. So the attitude behind the words is also very, very important to determine the quality or the energy of the words that are spoken.
Wonderful. In fact, Sai Prakash started off on a scientific note.
Right.
I was reminded of something similar that I had found some time ago. I had done a little bit research on the impact of sounds on our DNA.
Okay.
You know, we know that, you know, scientists say, you know, until some time back, you had modern scientists who said that only 2% of our DNA that manufacture proteins are what is are what are useful to us. And in fact, they said that the rest is junk DNA. I mean, that is what was believed until some 10, 15 years ago. They said, you know, means we, even though we are made only of that, they said 98% of that is junk. Mm-hmm. And this is something, you know, which certain Russian scientists never could accept it. You know, they felt it cannot be that, you know, we have nature doing something without any purpose. So they formed a team which consisted of linguists and geneticists. And they formed this venture to explore what this junk DNA is doing actually.
Mm.
Supposed to be junk DNA. And their results were simply revolutionary. What they found is our DNA is what is responsible not only for the construction of our body. You know, because scientists are looking at from the construction of our body. But it is this DNA which is also serving as data storage and also in communication. So, it is this so-called junk DNA which is helping in the evolving of our species. Mm. So, then they found that the genetic code, that because they had a team of linguists. So, the linguists found that the genetic code, what is there in the so-called junk DNA, it follows the same pattern as human languages. The same rules and pattern as human languages. So, it means that we speak the way we speak because our DNA is structured that way. And then this Russian biophysicist and another molecular biologist, Gorjajev, I don't know if I've got the pronunciation right, it's a Russian name. So that team, they explored now the vibrational behavior of the DNA and they found that since this DNAs communicate the same way as human languages communicate, they felt, they found out that you can actually change the genetic information of the DNA by having correct laser rays and radio waves.
Oh.
So if you have the correct laser rays and the proper radio waves, but the only catch was the frequency should be right.
Mm.
The frequencies are right, you can actually change the DNA. And that is when they did a lot of experiments with kind of what sort of sounds actually affect the DNA. And in fact, I was doing a program on mantras. Mm. That's when I discovered this. You know, that's how the mantras are so powerful. If you chant the mantras, like you chant the Gayatri mantra, you chant these Vedic mantras and you have these rishis, they were just doing this. It had literally changed their DNA. In fact, they say, you know, our DNA has 2 strands. Their DNA is, they say they had 12 strands. Their DNAs were, their DNAs were not like our DNAs. And that's how, you know, they had such prodigious intellectual abilities. Sitting just where they are sitting without any instruments, they were watching the deepest core of the universe. They were watching galaxies and planets beyond the solar system just by sitting where they are. I mean, their DNA was definitely not this 2-strand DNA. So he says the more evolved a person is, the easier it is to establish a conscious communication with the DNA. If you are evolved, then you can communicate with your DNA. That is why raising one's individual consciousness is very important to do any miracles. Because for you to do your miracles, you know, you should be able to communicate with DNA. And if you are evolved, and how will you be evolved? By the sound vibration. The sound vibrations will help you evolve.
Wonderful.
Mm. And the language and the sounds. So these sounds is what can interact with DNA. They will help us evolve. And once you are evolved, you can then, you know, work with the DNA and do miracles.
Very interesting. In fact, another study from, I believe, MIT, they found that before language came, before we started communicating through a language, we actually started communicating through song.
Song, oh, okay.
Through sounds. Because we saw sounds. The birds communicating.
Sounds.
We saw the birds communicating and before language came, I believe, we were singing.
Only sounds, yeah.
Sounds and singing.
Perhaps we were just listening to what nature was producing and
they say
thing.
That's why they say music and song has such a deep impact in us because it takes us back to those unsophisticated, possibly evolutionary years where the complexity of a language has not yet ruined our, you know, because it takes us back to something which is very, very, you know, ourselves.
Absolutely.
It is something which is ourselves. It is not complicated by the, you know, gymnastics of language.
Absolutely.
So music takes us back to that. And if you think of it that way, that is exactly what Swami has done by institutionalizing bhajan.
Bhajans, absolutely.
Now, if you look at it that way,
and Vedam,
Vedam and bhajans. Bhajans, so he says morning and evening at the same time. See, now if you look at the scientific research, they say that it's like what they say is a negative thought triggers an immediate response in your brain, but you need to have something like 4 to 6 positive thoughts to have a similar positive effect on the brain. Because a positive thought is not jeopardizing your survival. So since these instincts are all related to survival, the negative ones impact your brain further. So when Swami says namasmarna and positive thoughts,
you have to do more. Yeah.
It's not easy. It's not like you do once and say, "Arey, I did 108 one japa,
so,
I finished."
So the amount of damage that a negative thought does to you is not equal to the positive influence that a positive thought happens.
No.
You have to do much
more.
Yes.
They say if you have something like 4 to 6 or 8 positive thoughts, and the strength of those positive thoughts will trigger the impact that...
Unless you have a positive thought which is as strong.
Yes, which is very strong. That's why a concept like God, a positive thought like God, suddenly triggers, because that is one of the most powerful thoughts in our human consciousness.
Absolutely.
And when Swami says namasmarna, in simple terms, do namasmarna, in fact, I cannot help quoting again and again, in Dhyanavahini Swami says... Don't tell this secret to everybody because they will laugh at you.
Yes.
They'll tell you that, you know, what are you simply doing? Namasvarna, it's not so powerful. But I am assuring you, it is more powerful than any other sadhana. Just do namasvarna, he says. Yes. Very beautiful.
Amazing. In fact, you know, coming to little practical nuances of the power of sound, you know, from the realms of scientific...
Right.
Explorations. I'm reminded of Dr. Abdul Kalam. I don't know if you have read this anecdote about him. It seems when he was a kid, so one day in the night when his mother is serving food, so father also is sitting along with him, and mother serves dinner, and you know, it's a long hard day for the mother. And so mother places the food, and it was some vegetables and roti. And Kalam noticed that it was actually burnt roti. And he was saying, you know, what will father say? And father just looked at Kalam and, you know, as if nothing has happened. He asked, how was your school, you know, and it was just a normal conversation. And then he noticed his mother. Mother then realized that actually the roti is burnt. And the mother started apologizing to the father, you know. But his father said, no, I like burnt roti. You don't know, I like burnt roti. And then, so the dinner was fine. And later in the night, apparently every night before sleeping, he would go to his father and, you know, do goodbye and all that. So he went to his father and he asked, father, tell me one thing. Do you really like burnt roti? And the father took Kalam in his arms and he said, see, your mother put in a long, hard days of work and she made those rotis. You know, she would have had so many things to do. Probably she was very tired today. A burnt roti never hurts anyone. But harsh words do. I feel that is something very, very, you know, a burnt roti will not hurt anyone, but, you know, your one word can burn a hole in someone's life. In fact, talking about burning a hole, I remember another story. There was this boy who used to lose his temper very often. And his father said, okay, no problem. you know, you're not able to control your anger, it is okay. You do one thing, do just only this. Whenever you get angry, you go to our fence and you hammer a nail.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just do that. So the boy used to do that, you know, used to lose his temper like 30 times a day. But he would follow his father's advice, whatever injunction, scrupulously, and you go and hammer nails into the fence. And after some time, you know, this whole process of hammering nails into the fence becomes such a botheration that, you know, for that sake alone, he tried to control his temper, because who will go on hammering nails? So slowly it came down, actually, with time, you know, it became 20 and 10 and, you know, and he was liking that, you know, he doesn't have to go to the backyard and hammer a nail into the fence. And so slowly, eventually, you know, he almost succumbed. And then the father said, okay, very good. Now you do one thing. On the days when you have not got angry at all, one whole day you have not got angry, so that day you go and remove one nail. Okay, he said, okay, I will do this. So he started doing this, and you know, he was very eager to remove all the nails and, you know, tell his father that I have done it. So it took some time, and every day would count days. Today I'm not going to get angry. And then evening he would go and remove one nail. And so he finished removing all the nails, and then he went very proudly to his father and said, Father, I've removed all the nails. And father said, very good, fantastic, my son. And he, come, let's go. And he went there, and father said, can you see the fence now? How does it look? And he said, Father, it is okay. The father said, that is the difference, son. It will never be the same again. The fence has now so many deep holes. It is not as beautiful as it was before. So, you know, a harsh word will cause a hole. And whatever you may do, it's very difficult to heal that wound. And I think that is the reason why Swami was, you know, all the time insisting that speak lovingly, speak softly.
Yeah, in fact, it is often said that the tongue can inflict a hurt that is, you know, deeper than a sword. But one point which Swami is making here in this section is, in order to make the word soft and not harsh, you cannot use falsehood for that.
Yes.
If he says, if you add falsehood to make your word soft, then you are inviting greater misery.
Greater misery.
Right? Yes. So you have to ensure that it has the sweetness of truth. At the same time, it is soft. And Bhagavan would often, you know, say, Satyam Bruyat, Priyam Bruyat, Na Bruyat Satyam Apriyam.
Apriyam.
That is, Satyam Bruyat, speak the truth. Priyam Bruyat, speak lovingly.
Yes.
Na Bruyat Satyam Apriyam. Do not speak that which is an harsh truth.
Yeah.
Though it is truth, you may refrain from saying, but don't speak untruth in its place.
Don't speak untruth, yes.
Right?
Yes.
And in fact, this Chinnakatha, which sometimes referred to from the Mahabharata itself of Sage Durvasa.
Yes.
There is one version of Sage Durvasa where, you know, the Pandavas are made to hide below him by Lord Krishna.
Yes.
And then, you know, Durvasa says, no, if the soldiers of Duryodhana come and ask, I am going to tell them, I cannot speak untruth.
Untruth.
So Krishna says, no problem. you don't speak untruth. Speak the truth.
Yes.
But just tell it in your usual way. So, say Durvasa was seated and the soldiers came and they said, have you seen the Pandavas? Yes, yes, they are right under me, he said, in his usual tone. And they thought the sage was, you know, angry and they went away.
Yeah.
That is one example of speaking the truth, but, you know, to protect somebody.
Yes.
The other classic Chinnakatha that we often remember is, you know, when a sage was there and a hunter was chasing a deer, and the deer was innocent and it was running by, it looked at the sage, you know, with lot of, you know, feeling in its eyes, and it just ran behind the sage in one direction. So the hunter comes to the sage and then says, have you seen the deer? Now the sage cannot speak untruth. So he remains silent, and then the hunter continues to prod and says, if you don't tell, I will, you know, harm you. And at that time the sage says, see, what can I do? The eyes that that see cannot speak and the mouth that speaks cannot see. So how do I communicate to you? What the eyes have seen cannot be spoken by the eye. So what the mouth can communicate to you, while the mouth doesn't have the faculty of vision, so mouth has not seen anything to speak the truth. You know, so this, he used this clever yukti or tactic, yes. And the hunter was thoroughly confused and he moved away. So Swami often, told us that if you cannot always oblige, yes, at least speak obligingly. And here Swami says that if you are a sadhaka, these are some traits that you have to pick up.
Yes.
That is, speak obligingly.
Absolutely.
And try not to use harsh words, but don't replace it with falsehood in order to make it soft. So these are all very important practical warnings that Bhagavan has given us. And one interesting aspect is, you know, here Bhagavan says that of those who have become sadhakas, the mind is Mathura, the Hridayam or heart is Dwaraka, and the Deha body is Kashi. See, this one idea repeats again and again, which is very fundamental for any sadhaka, that is, Deho Devalyo Prokto Jivo Devas Sanatana. That is, body is a temple of God, and the indweller is God himself, right? So, body has to be treated as a temple. So it's not only restricted to the words, but every action that we perform through the body, that is right from bathing to eating to sleeping. That is why in our culture we sanctify everything. We pray before sleeping.
Yes.
We pray before food.
Yes.
We pray before, you know, taking up any actions.
Yes.
In fact, in Parthi there's such a beautiful culture. In the cricket field, before the match we chant Sai Gayatri, and if a wicket falls we all form a huddle and chant Sai Gayatri and shout Jai Bolo. So everywhere there is this vibrancy and feeling that it has to be sanctified, because body is a temple of God.
Yes.
But it's interesting to note these three things. Mind as Mathura, heart as Dwaraka, and Deha body as Kashi. One interpretation or one feeling that came to me was, if you see Lord Krishna's life, he conquered Mathura. Because Mathura was ruled by Kamsa, who is the representation of ego, ahankara and mamakara, right? And all the shadripus that follows after that. So he killed Kamsa and he conquered Mathura, which is representative of the mind. But he didn't dwell in the mind, right? So he established Dwaraka, which is the heart.
Wonderful.
So the Lord conquers the mind, establishes the heart, and time and again he reminds that the body is like Kashi. Means Kashi is the place which is famous for the Antim Prasthan. That is, if we remember our previous episode, what we were discussing.
Yes.
So body's destination is basically the graveyard at the end of the day.
Yes.
But the uniqueness of Kashi, it is said, is that there are so many great Jivan Muktas and great masters who used to live in Kashi, that when a pilgrim goes there, they facilitate the transcendence of the body during the final days of the bodily pilgrimage. So that is why there was a tradition in our country that elderly people would, you know, leave back all the responsibility with the youngsters, and they would travel to Kashi never to come back, and they would spend their last moments there.
Correct.
So body's destination is Kashi. That is, it is compared to Kashi because of the sacredness of it, to say that the body is given to you as an instrument to transcend the cycle of birth and death. But for that you have to conquer the mind and establish the heart.
I think that's a very beautiful way of understanding that, really. You know, even I was thinking about what Bhagwan means there when he's comparing the mind to Mathura, and it definitely occurred that, you know, Krishna established Dwaraka, so, you know, the Lord is...
And he conquered Mathura.
And he conquered Mathura. So I think that is very beautiful. In another discourse, you know, where Bhagwan was talking about this whole idea of speaking softly, Swami says for a person who speaks softly, wherever he stands, that place is Kashi.
Oh, okay.
That is what Swami was saying. Like, I mean, it is so important. I mean, the other way that I thought about that whole statement is, you know, what is Mathura, Kashi, and, you know, Dwarka? These are basically all the sacred places associated with the divine. I mean, Mathura has, I mean, it's Krishna's playground. Dwarka is something which Krishna, you know, made, he himself built it. So Kashi is again the Lord, you know, one of the holiest shrines. So I just felt the other thing is Swami is saying that, you know, for a sadhaka who speaks softly, you know, only when you speak softly, you are the mark of a sadhaka. Then, you know, your mind, your body, your heart, everything becomes sacred. It becomes like a Mathura, like a Dwaraka, like a Kashi. And that is another way I thought that Bhagavan is, you know, communicating to us that, you know, whatever you do, wherever you stand, that becomes Kashi. Whatever you think, you think as if you are in the presence of the Lord. You are in such a sacred space.
In fact, just like Mathura, which was ruled by Kamsa and, you know, all his denizens, Bhagavan here in this section also compares and says, he whose heart is ruled by the group of six vices, which is kama, krodha, lobha, moha, mada, matsarya, anger, jealousy, hatred, malice and the allied, you know, can only have ahamkara as the minister, you know. So,
yes,
you know, the ego itself becomes the guide of such a mind or yes, such a heart. And any heart or mind guided by the ego, you can imagine in what direction it is going to go. And that is why Bhagavan lays emphasis here and says that while the sadhakas have to begin with this preliminary practice to speak sweetly, softly and speak only the truth, but fundamentally their goal should be to uproot ego, yes, and ahankara and mamakara, yes, feeling of I and mine entirely. And unless they do that, there will be no progress in sadhana. And it's a classic example here Swami gives, an analogy, yes, where he says the fish. Yes. Can you imagine that? If we have some dirt on our clothes, or, you know, if some bad smell is coming from our hands or something like that, we immediately, you know, put water and wash our hands with soap and cleanse, and, you know, we use water to cleanse ourselves of dirt and, you know, bad smell. But the fish, which is all the time in the water, you know, it has not given up its tendency to exude bad smell. What an analogy. I mean, we should not extrapolate this too much and get into details, but the analogy is very specific to tell us, yes, that while we are swimming in the river of sadhana, it is important to get rid of all the negativities within us, or it will be like a pot with many holes.
Absolutely.
Like, for example, if you can imagine a mud pot with filled with amritam, you know, nectar, divine elixir, and you put holes into it now.
Yes.
So all the amritam that you fill through your sadhana,
yes,
is now going to leak through these holes.
Yes.
So the six vices, in fact, there is a discourse where Swami describes that there are 16 holes that we put into the pot. In fact, the 10-gated
yes,
pot which Swami is explaining here is the human body. And in spite of doing sadhana, what we do is we earn the grace of God by sadhana. Mm. That fills our life. But we put these holes into our, yes, you know, pot of sadhana. As a result, all the grace that we have earned are slowly, yes, leaking away. And the 16 holes that we put are the six vices, kama, krodha, lobha, moha, mada, matsalya. There is something called the ashta madhas. You know, you can Google and check this. There are 8 types of pride. Pride of youth, pride of handsomeness, pride of knowledge, pride of wealth, pride of good position. So there are 8 such types of pride.
And pride of spiritual attainment.
Pride of spiritual attainment.
Which is the most dangerous.
Which is the most dangerous. It's called the spiritual ego. And then you have ahankara ego and mamakara, which is feeling of me and mine. So all these put together are 16 vices actually. 16 negativity. possibilities. And these 16 negative disqualifications actually pierces holes into the pot which is accumulating the end result of all sadhana, which is the loving grace of God. So we're leaking away that grace of God by entertaining any of these 16 vices. So Swami is warning against that, and he says that you have to remove this dirt entirely. I am reminded of a very beautiful Chinnakatha again, you know, to illustrate this point. Swami was once narrating this, and he said there was a guru and he had many disciples. So the disciples were very eager to go on pilgrimage because they felt, you know, the whole year they are spending in the same place doing the same thing day in and day out. So they felt that they wanted to go. So they were, you know, nudging at each other to, you know, to go, who would go and represent the case to the guru. The guru saw that there was something building up, and he said, okay, now all of you come forward and tell what you want. Don't hesitate, you know. So then they presented the case and said, we want to go on a pilgrimage. Swamiji, why don't you permit us to go? We will go and come back as early as possible and all that. So the guru said, he thought for a while, and they were all nervous, what is he going to say? And he said, okay, on one condition. So they were eager to know what is that condition. And he said, I will give you one bitter gourd. Okay, so you carry that bitter gourd with you all through your pilgrimage. Every sacred shrine that you visit, you must place the bitter gourd along with your forehead on the ground, you know, at the shrine. If you go and have bath in sacred rivers like the Ganges, then you have to dip the bitter gourd also along with you in the river. So this is my only condition. Are you ready? So they found it very simple and easy, and they immediately agreed. So they took the bitter gourd royally as if it was the guru's insignia and went all around to their pilgrimage in Kashi, Badrinath and all that. And they had bath in Ganga, they dipped the bitter gourd, they placed it in all sanctorums and everywhere and got it back. And when they came back, they were all filled with so many stories of what all happened. So the guru said, oh, I'm very, very happy. So I'm going to organize a banquet, you know, in honor of your achievement of having gone through many kshetras and sacred places in, that is your sadhana that you have done. So I want to honor you. So let's have a banquet. And he called one of the disciples and said, make special vegetable out of this bitter gourd. So he cut the bitter gourd and, you know, served personally to every disciple of his and said, before you start anything, first you eat the bitter gourd, you know. So when they ate the bitter gourd, of course, it was very pungent in its taste, and you know, they were making all kinds of faces and they're cringing. And they said, Guru, we were having a wonderful time and we were enjoying our why did you give us this bitter gourd? He said, see, the bitter gourd also traveled with you, you know, to all the sacred shrines, to the most holiest of places. It put all the effort that you have also put, but at the end it has not changed its nature. It was bitter before, it is bitter now. So unless you make that fundamental change in you, the transformation happens from inside. The bitterness, the ego and the feeling of me and mine is uprooted. As a sadhaka, your sadhana is not complete. You're just like the fish that is swimming in the water, yet it exudes lot of bad odor. In the same way, the sadhaka is swimming in the river of sadhana, and it would only boost his ego to think that I am a great sadhaka, but at the end, you know, there would be no result. So this is a beautiful way how, you know, these kind of things can be told very strictly to a disciple also, you know, by the guru. But look at how beautifully Swami communicates it by giving analogies and stories.
Even the other example, Swami says, you know, a donkey will never ever get the fragrance of what it is carrying, you know, the donkey, even if it's carrying sandalwood, it won't become an elephant, it won't have that kind of a perspective and that kind of understanding of, you know, what it is carrying. So again, you know, Swami is saying, basically, to put it simply, all that you do, all your so-called sadhana, all that so-called learning, all your so-called mastery of scriptures, is all that is of no avail if you are not doing anything to clean yourself. And in fact, I was just reminded also in this context of the story from Mahabharata of Arjuna and Karna fight. I don't know if you have heard this story. Basically, the fight between Arjuna and Karna was one of the most glorious battles in Mahabharata. And apparently, when the battle was going on, Krishna was so impressed with Karna that Krishna was all the time actually praising Karna.
Mm-hmm.
And it would happen that Arjuna would shoot an arrow,
mm-hmm.
and Karna's chariot would go back like 30-40 feet. Mm-hmm. He would totally go completely haywire.
Mm.
And then still he would, you know, regroup himself and shoot an arrow. And Krishna's chariot, Arjuna's chariot, would go back like 3-4 feet.
Mm.
Okay. And so the day ended, and then Arjuna, you know, he could not contain this, you know. I was such a fantastic warrior today, you know, but still Krishna has no words of praise for me. He's all the time only praising Karna.
Mm.
And then Krishna smiles and says, Arjuna, do you have any clue about who is there on top of your chariot?
Mm.
Hanuman is sitting on top of your chariot.
Mm.
I am there as your charioteer.
Mm.
Seshanag, Adisesha is there as the wheels of your chariot.
Mm.
Even then,
your chariot moved.
Your chariot moved 3-4 feet away.
Mm.
Karna had nobody. He was just alone.
Mm.
Still he could be so valiant. And, you know, the story goes how, you know, in the end of the war, where, you know, when Krishna asks Arjuna to get down, and Arjuna's, you know, his pride is hurt, and he says, you know, first the charioteer has to get down, and then finally Krishna gets down and the chariot gets completely burnt after that. And that is when Krishna tells Arjuna that your chariot was burnt that day Karna shot arrows.
Mm.
That day itself your chariot was not supposed to be there. It was only because I am there.
I suppressed the energies.
Yes, that is the reason why you are existing. This chariot is existing. And the war went on. I mean, what I'm trying to say is, you know, most of the times especially in these times of, you know, wrong idea of self-confidence, of someone being self-made, and all those ideas, you know, in the modern lingo and in the modern philosophies, you know, we forget that the whole thing about we being self-made, you know, the ego comes out of that, and you think, I have achieved it, you know, I have done this, I have this great talent, I have written this book, or, you know, I have been able to produce this, I was able to get this kind of profit to the company. This whole thing comes out of that, only when you realize that, but only when you know that you are nothing, you know, your chariot probably would have been burnt long ago, if God's grace was not there, or if there were so many forces of the universe, there are so many forces of society, because of so many forces of family, so many people consciously, unconsciously, visibly, invisibly, covertly, overtly, they have supported you, and that is why you are what you are. And I think that understanding perhaps, you know, will help us to develop that kind of a humility that is very much needed. And, you know, whether you're on the spiritual path or not, everybody is on the spiritual path, whether they know it or not. But I think this perspective is what will really help
in
us
fact,
to curb our ego.
Swami used to put it in very succinct words and say, if you cooperate,
yes,
I will operate.
Operate. Yeah.
But if you operate, I will not cooperate. So, whether it's any work that we take up, it is all, of course, the feeling, the bhava that we have behind the work that is very, very important.
Yes.
And Swami always reminds us that take everything that happens to you as prasadam of the Lord. And in Bhagavad Gita, in fact, the phrase is prasada buddhi.
Yes.
That is a mind that always takes everything as God's prasadam.
Yes.
And even our ability to speak, walk, talk, do even to think in this direction is Swami's grace. In fact, we all remember how Swami told one of the devotees that if I want, I will stop you from thinking about me.
Yes.
So it is really just Swami's grace.
Yes.
And if we are able to remind this, that it is the Sadguru Guru's grace that is making us even do the sadhana. Mm. And our entire life is only a leela of God. Mm. If we are able to know this, experience this, and you know, live in this experience, that it is, all our lives are just leela of Bhagwan, nothing else.
Then we will always be in prema.
Yes, we'll just be in prema, and in prema. And we can, yes, keep the ahank, the two,
yes,
unwanted companions that we entertain, yes, of ahankara and mamakara, away from our sadhana.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I think it's just that, you know, we don't want to actually end this discussion. It's such a lovely session, but we have to respect the clock and people's time. So, dear listeners, please share your thoughts. You know, it's. I know these topics are endless. You're talking about, you know, getting rid of ego. You're talking about speaking softly. You're talking about the purifying our tendencies. So these are all endless topics, but you know, we all have to make our little efforts in this direction. And if you have done something, if you want to share your experience, your learning, your experiments, please feel free. As always, you can write to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you so much for being with us. We offer this lovely session at the Lord's feet of Bhagwan with gratitude and love. Thank you so much. Saram.